Q101 is WKQX Chicago. I'm Marge Halperin on the Chicago Beat. Tonight we'll talk with author Russell Miller to find out what it was really like inside Chicago's Playboy Mansion and what life is like for Hugh Hefner today.
Nothing is more important than Mr. Hefner in the mansion. The whole aim of the place is to fulfill his every need. That's why he has never grown up. That's why he is a perpetual Peter Pan figure. I notice he described himself. But I would describe him as a sort of spoiled adolescent.
We'll check in with some Vietnam vets who are still having trouble finding civilian jobs 15 years after the war.
I haven't had an experience where I'm welcome just because I'm a Vietnam vet. There have been times when I told people I wasn't a Vietnam vet because sometimes people paint a picture of you being something that you're really not, a drug addict, a baby killer, whatever.
We'll find out why humorist Dave Jaffe thinks today's athletes are too serious about their sport and about their health.
When I wrestled in high school, there was a different approach to nutrition. Coach Wisniewski would say, "Jaffe, you're a big fat pig, don't eat for a week." So I wouldn't, and I'd lose my match. Then I'd go have a pizza.
We'll also hear Q101 sports director Pat Benkowski's Chicago Baseball All-Stars. We'll visit Chicago's Pipe and Tobacco Museum and taste some authentic Cajun food in Evanston tonight on the Chicago Beat. But first, our look at the problems that vets are having sliding into civilian life. In the 1970s, the slogan was, "Don't forget, hire a vet." But by now, many employers have forgotten, and vets, especially those who served in Vietnam, are having trouble getting a civilian job.
Navy cruiser, South Pacific.
Check that seal.
Casing seal looks good.
You're rebuilding a pump that's bigger than the car you drove in high school.
Output pressure's good.
As a highly trained machinist's mate, you know exactly what you're doing.
Power on.
Imagine, the Air Force Reserve can offer you top-notch training and hands-on experience on some of the most advanced equipment in the world. Now add to this the many other benefits of the Air Force Reserve.
Signal intelligence. Does that sound difficult? It is. But if you can take on the challenge of being trained in an Army signal intelligence skill, you can qualify for a bonus of up to $8,000.
All that you can be.
The new training programs in all branches of the military seem to be successful. Those who leave the service with a skill that translates into a civilian job usually have little trouble finding work. It's a different story for those who get only generic training, though the Veteran Administration's Bill Jane says they have civilian skills too.
You take someone on the deck of an aircraft carrier in the Indian Ocean for 100 days at a time, landing a several million-dollar airplane on the deck of an aircraft carrier. They may not have done anything that's got any sort of a direct counterpart in civilian life, but they've sure learned a lot about teamwork, responsibility, dedication, discipline, that sort of stuff that it translates into a job asset.
But just try to demonstrate those skills to a prospective employer. Javé Kimball's been trying for 15 years, ever since he left Vietnam.
No, my shoes should be shined. I should have creases in my pants, clean shirt, tie, and look my best. You know, and get to work on time, and that's what I like to do, and give your employer a full day's work for a full day's pay.
When he says that, Kimball finds many employers hear something entirely different.
People still have a stereotype of Vietnam veterans as being somewhat drug-induced, shiftless, and somewhat rebellious.
Charles Johnson has had so much trouble looking for work that he often skips his military service on a job application.
I haven't had an experience where I'm welcome just because I'm a Vietnam vet. There have been times when I told people I wasn't a Vietnam vet because sometimes people paint a picture of you being something that you're really not, a drug addict, a baby killer, whatever.
An estimated 50,000 vets are looking for a job in the Chicago area. Most served in Vietnam. They seem to carry this special burden, even though many have been beefing up their qualifications over the past 15 years. Tommy Jefferson has added a degree in public administration and a computer programming certificate, but he is still bombarded with questions from prospective employers turned off by his military service.
Why did you go to Vietnam? Or, a lot of people didn't go and got out of going, and weren't you smart enough not to go? Military people that went to Vietnam tend to be non-disciplined, don't like to take orders, negative to our society that sent them there.
There is a feeling that vets, especially those who went to Nam, are somehow inferior to other job applicants. The VA's Bill Jane says statistically that's just not true.
Over 90% of the enlisted people in the military today have a high school education or better. Over 90% of the officers have a college degree. The people in the military today are very high quality.
The problem is to prove that to employers, who often have other criteria for hiring, as Javé Kimball found out when he applied for a road construction job with the state.
Instead of looking at my qualifications and asking me what I could do for them, the question was, who sent you? My immediate reply was that Uncle Sam sent me.
That answer didn't carry enough clout, which surprised Kimball. He and thousands of others returned from Vietnam thinking they would carry clout, would be rewarded for their service. But Kimball isn't bitter, just sorry the Army of the 1960s didn't have the training and psychological preparation available in the Army of the 80s.
In Vietnam, I was in a very stressful situation, and coming back, I stayed unemployed for about a month. I found the need for money, so I went back to work, and without an adjustment period, I had problems just with dealing with being back in the world, as we like to say.
But Kimball is a survivor, something he thinks should help him get a job.
Give the vets who went and came back a chance for gainful employment and help them. You know, it's a problem that we did not create ourselves. It's a problem of a natural circumstance or something that happened to us. Take a chance on us.
As they used to say in the 70s, don't forget, hire a vet.
Just staying busy means a lot. When you have a lot of time on your hand, you have a lot of time to think. And most of the time when you're thinking, you're unemployed, that's a negative thought. And you get to thinking about what's happening with you in the past. I just say, if I get this job, if I'm working, I can deal.
Years after his new magazine scandalized the nation, Hugh Hefner recently returned to Chicago a cultural hero. But is his contribution to society overrated? Author Russell Miller thinks so. He's been studying the life and fantasies of Hugh Hefner, starting with that very first magazine.
The brilliance of Playboy magazine, in my view, was that it made its pitch directly to a mythical man-about-town figure. Now, this was a man that could go into any restaurant and would immediately be recognized and would be given the best table, could catch the waiter's eye without any difficulty. He was a man who could uncouple any known bra with one hand and mix a martini with the other. I mean, he was one of life's winners. And the pitch was such that it would tell you, for example, what to wear on a yacht, or how to give a dinner party for 80 people, or how to behave when you've had a weekend party at a country house. Now, what this did, in effect, was to enable the purchaser of the magazine to join the set, even though only in fantasy. So you could be an insurance salesman in Peoria, Illinois, with a mortgage and a wife and three children and all kind of financial problems. But by buying Playboy, you suddenly had a passport to this wonderful fantasy world.
Now, when Hefner started this, he wasn't a part of that set, was he?
Not at all. Hefner wasn't that character in any way at all. He had a crew cut, white socks, he was awkward with women, he was not particularly sociable, but then you see he was like his readers.
He built that kind of life for himself as the magazine took off. We've heard so many rumors and stories about what really happened in the mansion, especially in Chicago, because the mansion was in Chicago, is in Chicago. You separate some of those, there really aren't that many myths. It was a pretty wild life, wasn't it?
Playboy never denied any rumor ever. So if a rumor went around Chicago that there had been the most amazing and astonishing and bacchanalian orgy there, it would never be denied by Playboy. So therefore, you know, rumors were allowed to foster and grow. But much of the time, you know, the parties were ritualized. There was, you know, the Friday night party and the Sunday night party, and very often Hefner didn't even make an appearance. And I think you could do what you liked in the mansion pretty well. I mean, you could certainly order any food and have as much to drink as you liked, and you could watch the latest movies. And if you were lucky enough to persuade a bunny to go to bed with you, then lucky old you. But you had to do it that way round. You couldn't. The bunnies were never provided as a service, as was commonly believed. You know, there was a story going around that when the guest arrived at the mansion, he was shown up to his room, and as part of the service, like the room service,
the waiter or the butler would say, oh, would you like a bunny, sir? That never happened. It was never like that at all. I mean, Hefner would never have countenanced a kind of organized provision of bunnies for the gratification of the guests.
But he stocked his party with plenty of bunnies, didn't he, for that purpose?
Of course. The purpose, I think, of having the girls around in quantity, always twice as many girls as blokes, was that it helped create and promote the Playboy image. They were really never there to service the male guests. That was a common misconception that was widely rumoured and widely believed, too. But that wasn't the case. The fact was, of course, a lot of sex went on, and there were certainly the occasional orgy, if an orgy can be described as people having sex in changing combinations all together in one room. No question that went on. But I don't think anybody was necessarily coerced. I mean, no girl was ever told, right, it's orgy night tonight and you're going to be in it. She could say no. Girls were allowed to say no. And the atmosphere of the mansion was such that when a girl arrived, it was quickly made clear that, you know, this is the way it is here. And if you didn't like it, really the only alternative, notwithstanding what I said earlier, if you weren't prepared to go along with it, then the only sensible alternative would be not to move into the mansion, not to move up into the dormitory, but to find a place outside.
Now, the other picture you paint of the mansion is the way in which it revolved around Hefner. You really make him look like a tyrant and really pretty petty more than that. His tirades about lumpy gravy, why was that so important to him?
You see, Hefner has very little to worry about. He doesn't worry about the business. The business is in absolutely dire straits. The business is tumbling around his ears, but he appears to care nothing for that. What he worries about is the minutiae of his life. The Los Angeles mansion has a staff of 90 people. It's not a very big house, but it has a staff of 90, and their only duty is to cater to Mr. Hefner's every whim and provide him with every comfort. So if one of his favorite video machines was suddenly to break down, no matter what time of the day or night it is, there would be an electronics engineer specially trained who would be able to come straight into the game's house and mend it for Mr. Hefner. Because nothing is more important than Mr. Hefner in the mansion. And so everything revolves around him, and the whole aim of the place is to fulfill his every need.
Did he really throw a tirade about his gravy?
Yes, he does. I mean, you see, because nothing else is important to him apart from his own pleasures, the texture and the quality of the gravy becomes very important. He eats nothing but fried chicken and pot roast, and he has the gravy with the pot roast. And yes, it's a very important matter to him about the gravy. You see, that's why he has never grown up. That's why he is a perpetual Peter Pan figure. I notice he described himself, but I would describe him as a sort of spoiled adolescent who was still living out, seeking and living out fantasies.
You say that he wasn't paying attention to the business as it was falling apart. Certainly he's still a very wealthy man, but the business is not what it was. What has happened to the Playboy empire, and why do you think some of the clubs have had to close and these other things?
Well, the real terrible problem for Playboy was when they lost the gaming license in London. They had a casino at the Playboy Club in London, which was patronized by Arabs, who and very rich Arabs with petrodollars to burn. And while that income was still pouring out of London and into the coffers in Chicago, didn't actually much matter that the clubs have been losing money for a long time, that Playboy had built and opened two enormously expensive hotels that had never made a profit from day one, that the model agency wasn't doing very well, that you know, all the various diversifications were actually not very successful. But at the minute they no longer had the money from London, then you could see that Playboy was a shell, absolutely ready to collapse. And they had to cut away all of those loss-making operations. I mean, Playboy today, it really only comprises three elements. And the first is the magazine, the second is the clubs, and the third is the new Playboy cable television channel.
You know, you aren't being very kind, but I think generally you have to say that he did make a contribution to our society, didn't he? Was it one that we can thank him for? Did he, you know, he'll give himself credit for shaping our culture in the liberated, era, even though he may be rather backward in his opinion toward women.
Yeah, I think if we look, if you say, I wonder how society in the 21st century is going to consider Hefner, you know, after he's gone, because he can't live forever, hasn't discovered the secret of eternal life yet. But I think they would say, well, here we have a fascinating man, interesting, unusual man, slightly bizarre man, perhaps, who did, in the middle of the 1950s, introduce a breath of fresh air into a restrictive, puritanical, and perhaps a society unhappy with itself. Yeah, and I'd give him and Playboy absolutely full credit for that. Where I think he's on much more dangerous ground is the idea that all of these social changes have largely can all be dated back, you know, to the concept of Playboy and the Playboy philosophy. No, it's not true. Social change isn't promulgated by a magazine. Social change is promulgated by other events. Woodstock, the hippie movement, the beat movement, music, many, many things have changed our society. It was a dangerous and pioneering thing that he did, and that's wonderful. But you know, I think that is the extent of the contribution. I think you can pin it down in the 50s, and now we see rather sad man, a corporation in disarray, and a man still believing that he's up there, you know, on the stage, strutting the American scene, with wielding a great deal of influence. And I see a man sitting out there in black pajamas who nobody really much cares about.
Congratulations to you if you were among the 12,000 runners in last week's Chicago Marathon. Humorist Dave Jaffe was not part of that crowd.
I just want to explain why I didn't run in the marathon, because it's not what you think. It's not that I'm out of shape. I stand 6'3", weigh 190 pounds, all of it lean, tan, solid muscle. I can chin myself 50 times with one finger and outpace a Corvette on the straightaway. Because I'm saying all this on the radio, right now only my wife and friends are laughing. The rest of you must be thinking, geez, he couldn't say that if it wasn't true. But just for the sake of argument, let's pretend I'm, oh, say, 5'9", 195 pounds, haven't chinned myself since a rather humiliating phys ed test in high school, and the only exercise I get is coughing. Even that wouldn't prevent me running the marathon. I stayed out of the race because long-distance runners just are too darn serious about their sport. Take, for example, the runner's eating habits. 6 months before the race, a good friend of mine swore off beef. Not for the normal yuppie fear of a heart attack, but because of some magical alchemical imbalance beef causes. The night before the race, he attended what runners call a carbo-load dinner, where you sit down to a plate of pasta and French bread, water, spaghetti, noodles, bread, water, toast, bread, vermicelli, water, and water. When I wrestled in high school, there was a different approach to nutrition. Coach Wisniewski would say, "Jaffe, you're a big fat pig, don't eat for a week." So I wouldn't, and I'd lose my match. Then I'd go have a pizza. Runners also take their fans seriously to the point where they hire them. "You're going to be there, aren't you?" my friend quizzed me. "You don't want me suffering that loneliness of the long-distance runner thing." I said there'd be 10,000 other runners to keep him company. "But I know a guy who gave his friends Mickey Mouse ears and bike horns so he could spot them cheering." "What time is the race?" I asked. "Warm up is 7 a.m., he said. For the sake of that friendship, early Sunday morning I showered, put on my mouse ears, grabbed my horn, and spent 2 hours in front of the TV. I hope he saw me. I'm Dave Jaffe on the Chicago Beat. Just like us.
I guarantee you don't have to travel to the bayou to sample real Cajun delights. Sandy Houseman found some tasty samples in Evanston.
You probably don't want to spend much time outside Elvord's restaurant. Construction is well underway at the Chicago and Northwestern station at Davis Street. But inside the depot, there's a whole different sound.
Listening to that bebop music, moving me out, grooving me out every night to a little club on N Street.
While the Chef Dave Augusto simmers spicy Cajun specialties in the kitchen, jazz musicians like Laurel Massé are cooking in the dining room. And strolling back and forth, a 36-year-old man wearing a tweed jacket and a generous smile.
My name is James Elvord. I'm originally from Madison, Wisconsin. And prior to getting into the restaurant business, I was in the music business. I was an arranger, and I dealt with marching bands and drum and bugle corps around the country and Canada.
As a young man, Elvord worked in his parents' sandwich shop in Madison. He was one of 11 kids. So when Jim decided to open his own eatery in Evanston, he called on the E-Team. Seven Elvord brothers and three sisters descended on the railroad depot, gutted the inside, and created the dining room and performance space, which opened in June of 83. When you walk in today, you're likely to find Jim standing by the door with some of his favorite wines, most from small vineyards in California and beyond.
We're also getting wine out of Oregon, Washington, state of Washington, and Idaho and Virginia. That's a very high quality.
Now, not everyone's willing to spring for a bottle of Virginia's finest, so Jim offers some incentive.
Rather than having a wine list, what we've decided to do is to set out a table on the weekends where you get in and you can taste the wine. Why read about it when you can taste it?
And the same philosophy applies to the entertainment provided by vintage jazz musicians from Chicago and other cities. Elvord offers a free sample every time.
You may have to go to other parts of the city and pay a minimum and a cover to see them. Or if you were to go to other parts of the country, you'll pay the minimum, the cover, plus have to have dinner.
So how do you make money?
That's a good question. You should ask my account.
Meals are very modestly priced and often feature seafood.
We do our version of black and red fish, which we call black and ruffy. We have some interesting things like seafood lasagna, which you'll never see anyplace else other than here, to the best of my knowledge. Another lovely Cajun dish that we have is honey mustard shrimp. We deep fry it in the shrimp in the Chinese fashion, but then we then coat it with a Creole Cajun mustard sauce.
And while you're waiting for your food to arrive, you can study the modern artwork on Elvord's wall or create some of your own. Each table is covered in brown paper and comes with a jar of crayons. Jim Elvord has seen some excellent doodling and some drawings, which say a lot.
I can say that I've seen situations where people have been from the Board of Trade and they've just made it big. And they'll tell you that. I've seen other situations where someone has had a really bad week.
Good or bad, Jim gloats over one other result, saying that he no longer sees graffiti in Elvord's bathrooms. See all of these things for yourself, 7 days and nights a week, at 1620 Railroad Avenue in Evanston. Enter through the tunnel on Maple Street between Davis and Church. And don't mind the mess. On the Chicago Beat, I'm Sandy Houseman.
Wonderful things that you get in life, there are four. Baby, and there may not be many, but nobody needs any more. Of the many facts, making the list of life. Truth takes the lead, but to relax, knowing the gist of life. Well, it's truth you need. Well, the second is honor, and happiness makes number three. Hey, when you put them together, you know what the last one must be. Fame is all the truth, and honor, and happiness. Add one thing more, and you know the wonderful, wonderful love that'll make it more. And baby, there ain't no more.
If you like to top off a good meal with a good smoke, join Dave McBride at a Chicago institution.
On South Wabash, just south of Madison Street, a canopy extends over the sidewalk proclaiming the name of Yvonne Reese and Company, a company that's been doing business downtown since before there was a loop. An elevator ride to the second floor and a short walk down a plush hallway, and one is inside the walnut-paneled showroom of one of the most interesting tobacconists anywhere. Its proprietor is Stanley Levy.
We carry the largest selection of pipes anywhere in the world, ranging in price from $1.25 corn cob to $1,000 briar. Our pipes are set up for self-service. There are 65 drawers of pipes that they can browse through with every shape and from every country that makes good pipes.
Stanley took over the business from Yvonne Reese after he married Reese's daughter, and has shepherded its growth into an internationally known catalog pipe and tobacco seller. Worth a visit is the tobacco store's own museum of meerschaum pipes, displaying intricately carved pipes, worth in some cases up to $50,000 each to collectors.
These are meerschaum pipes made in the 1700s and 1800s. They're works of art that have been lost today. There's no one to carve these pipes. There's one pipe is a battle between Austria and Italy, has over 100 figures carved. And this size Mershom block is really no longer available. The Mershom comes from Turkey. It means seafoam. Evidently, there was an eruption of some kind, and a lot of this was on the sea, and it looked like seafoam, so that's where it got its name.
Stanley Levy numbers some notables among his clients. At least two presidents have smoked Yvonne Rees pipes or tobacco. Irv Kupcinet is a regular customer, as is Milton Berle and Mickey Rooney. On display is a tightly wrapped bundle of tobacco that was discovered in a trunk owned by George Washington. It's an example of tobacco money, an item that was often used as currency before the new United States created its own paper money. Levy notes that tobacco provided much of the income which financed the revolution. Levy's father-in-law watched the first Yvonne Rees Company go up in smoke in the Great Chicago Fire. And at that time, in 1871, Chicagoans had already been buying Rees pipes and tobacco for 14 years. Pipe smokers, says Levy, take their smoking seriously.
A $5 pipe, they'll pay $10 to have fixed. A pipe is an individual, is a possession that men get more attached to than anything inanimate they own.
Rees has a corner of its shop given over to machinery, where pipe owners can clean and polish their prized pipes, and where more than a dozen varieties of fine tobaccos may be sampled. And one entire wall is actually a glass deep freeze, where premium cigars are stored. Cigars from the Canary Islands or the Dominican Republic. Cigars selling for up to $3.50 each. Not only does Stanley Levy not think that what this country needs is a good 5-cent cigar, he wouldn't pay a nickel for a Havana, still banned by the U.S. for import. He says he's tried recent Havanas, and they are inferior to the Canary Islands smokes. And quality, says Levy, is everything. After all, as Rudyard Kipling wrote in The Betrothed, his poem, about a man who has been given an ultimatum by his fiancée to choose between his cigars and her, a woman is only a woman, but a good cigar is a smoke. I'm Dave McBride on the Chicago Beat.
And before we say goodbye tonight, let's say goodbye to Chicago's 1985 baseball stars. Here's Q101 sports director Pat Binkowski.
Since it's World Series week and major publications are already revealing their 1985 baseball award winners, I think it's about time we name the All-Chicago All-Star baseball team for this season. I picked 13 players who I thought excelled under some pretty negative circumstances with both the Cubs and White Sox. Let's start with pitchers. I chose Tom Seaver as a starter, not only for winning his 300th career victory this year, but being a reliable starter at age 40, even though he was often the victim of bad defense and some weak hitting when he pitched. Britt Burns, the left-handed starter, even though he had a shot at 20 games and fell a little short with 18, I thought Big Britt made a great comeback from a lost 1984 season and should be even better in 1986. Reliever-wise, the Cubs' Lee Smith and Bob James both had excellent years, and nobody else came close. Catcher Carlton Fisk hit a career-high 37 homers, set an American League record for the position, and showed some great power production at age 37. At first base, Leon Durham of the Cubs came on hitting-wise later in the year. I gave him the nod at first base over Greg Walker of the White Sox, who I made my DH. At second base, Ryne Sandberg certainly is the winner. With 26 homers, 54 stolen bases, Rhino had a shot at being the MVP in the National League if the Cubs had been contenders. At third base, sort of a controversial pick, because of a great crowd in the outfield, I brought in Keith Moreland and put him at the hot corner. He was the Cubs' cleanup hitter late in the year, batted .307, drove in 106 runs, and I think he'll even be better on the north side next year. At shortstop, an easy choice. White Sox rookie Ozzie Guillen, who was superb on defense, showed great poise for a 21-year-old and hit about .270 all year. I think he's a lock for the American League Rookie of the Year award. In the outfield, more controversy maybe. Harold Baines is certainly a lock. The American League superstar hit .309 with 22 homers and 113 runs batted in. But because of their great play off the bench, I chose two Cubs, Thad Bosley in center field and Davey Lopes in left. Bosley was a top pinch hitter in the National League, and Lopes, incredibly, at age 39, stole 47 bases. He might be one of the greatest base stealers of all time. So there they are, the Chicago All-Stars for 1985. If you have any trouble with them, or if you particularly like my picks, give me a call in regular business hours during the week at 861-7940. Right now, I'm working on my football choices. On the Chicago Beat, I'm Pat Binkowski.
And I'm Marge Halperin. You can hear the Chicago Beat the final Sunday of each month at midnight. Thanks for joining us. 101 is WKQX Chicago.
You know, when I played for the president, everybody said, Blasta, gee, what do you want? You know, you've really got to the top. And I said, no, you don't get to the top till you're on Johnny Carson's show.
You've got to love people. You've got to love what you're doing. I get up in the morning, I thank the Lord for give me all the blessing that I received all these years to run for public office 24 times, 22 times. Nobody filed against me, even for public nuisance.
I've been an Uncle fan since it aired. And I was about 9 years old when the show first aired in 1964. And it just struck a nerve with me. It turned out to be a very entertaining show, and I really got hooked on it.
Definitely a romantic thing for a man to say is, I want to buy you the biggest bouquet of posies that you've ever had. And then you pull up, and you can buy her perhaps 36 roses for $7. Wouldn't that be great?
I'm Marge Halperin on the Chicago Beat. Tonight we'll meet Chicago's polka queen, visit a convention of TV spy buffs, and discover Chicago's most romantic places. But first, some survival tips from the Dean of Chicago City Council.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
Chicago Alderman Vito Marzullo turned 88 this month with the now ritual City Hall lunchtime bash. He's beginning to slow down a bit, attending fewer city council meetings and spending more time at home, less in the office. But he begins every day with a word of thanks.
You've got to love people. You've got to love what you're doing. I get up in the morning. I thank the Lord for giving me all the blessing that I've received all these years to run for public office 24 times, 22 times. Nobody filed against me, even for public nuisance.
Marzullo was elected 7 times to the state legislature, 7 times as ward committeeman, and 9 times to the city council in his 45-year political career. But poor health has made him give up the committeeman post, and his 83 aldermanic race was the only close one he ever ran, beating challenger Juan Velasquez with just 59% of the vote. The increasing Hispanic population in Marzullo's ward is a nagging problem for the alderman. He tends to approach the Hispanics and their problems as you'd expect an 88-year-old Italian-born man to do.
They come to me with a chip on their shoulder, then I tell them if they don't like, go back to Mexico. That's the only place you can do that. I don't believe in them muscling their way through. Sometimes you find somebody follow the alderman, we got certain demands to make. That's enough for me. I said, that's enough. Get out and stay out of here.
One group that particularly angered Marzullo was from a neighboring ward trying to make changes on his turf.
Three young men are demanding this, Alderman, we want this done. Well, that dago blood of mine came up. I said, you son of a bee. I said, get out of here and never come back here. I said, where do you live? What are you doing over here? You want to help our people over here? I said, you so-and-so, get out of here and never come back again, because if you do, you never go out alive.
That's all the more distressing for Marzullo because he's built his career on the old school of politics, offering voters a combination of friendship and service.
Service in the sense of the old ward healers approach of garbage can lids, getting a kid out of trouble with the law, maybe fixing a traffic ticket or two, things bordering on the questionable. He's not what you'd call an ultra-progressive.
Chicago Sun-Times reporter Harry Golden has been covering Marzullo for 19 years. The qualities he paints in such a harsh light are a source of pride to Marzullo.
A good public servant to people of all walk of life. Don't have to have a certain nationality, race, or creed, or religion.
But in fact, Marzullo seems to have trouble blinding himself to race, creed, and religion. Not so surprising for a man who came here as an immigrant himself at the age of 12. He brags that he is an American and has little patience for ethnic groups wanting help for their constituents. From the outside, that might be labeled as bigotry. But Harry Golden says it's Marzullo's brand of patriotism.
Vito once told me that from the moment he stepped off the boat from Italy, his goal was to be an American. He says he loved America even when he was in Italy, and he was preaching Americanism even before he knew the English language.
The boy's gonna get his egg. The little boy's gonna cut his cake.
And that cake at Marzullo's 88th birthday party was as patriotic as the alderman himself, decked out in American flags. To Marzullo, the American way has been synonymous with the democratic machine, which turned a poor immigrant factory worker into public servant, helping him win one office after another. Marzullo took Mayor Daley's death very hard, but insists he does not mourn the passing of Daley's machine.
I don't lose any sleep over it. Let the chip fall where they belong. I don't care what they want to do with it. My age, I got to worry what the Democratic or the Republican or Independent Party is going to do.
But no. Marzullo does miss the machine. He thinks the city functioned more smoothly with patronage and can't understand why others would reject the system.
Under the old system, if you were working my office and you get married and you quit politics, I could place you here with someone that I'd recommend. Nowadays, you can't do that. So what good is it?
And the man who proudly claims to have stomped on patronage's grave is the first mayor Marzullo's ever met, whom he didn't like.
I used to get along with Jane Byrne. I used to get along with Cermak. I used to get along with Thompson.
But you don't get along with Washington.
Well, I don't have no personal grudge against him. Politically, I don't get along.
Marzullo has tried to reconcile with Mayor Washington, talking with him soon after his term began.
I told him one day, Mayor, why don't you change your attitude a little bit? What? He said, well, they don't like my attitude. Well, I said, they don't like your attitude because you want to control everything. We're not in Germany, Italy, or Poland.
But that talk went nowhere, and Marzullo is now a faithful member of the Verdoliak 29. That status made it tough for Washington to sing Marzullo's praises on the alderman's recent birthday, though he tried to be diplomatic.
Senior Deacon, a wonderful man, charming, brought a lot of credit to our country, city.
Would you like to see him run for re-election when he's 90?
No.
In fact, Washington is likely to back a challenger to Marzullo in 1987 if the then 90-year-old has the energy to run for re-election. After his last close call, many observers think Marzullo will bow out rather than risk political humiliation as a cap to his career. Marzullo is mum about his future plans, saying he'll let God and his constituents make the decision.
I got a nice family. I got a world of friends. There's no use making any plans to run with people like this. At your beck and call and tell me, what else do I want?
From the man who's entertained mayors, we move on now to the woman who entertained a president, and this report from Sandy Hausman.
Happy birthday, President Reagan, on this day you were born. Happy birthday, we wish you many more. Happy birthday, enjoy yourself and don't be blue. Close your eyes, blow out your candles, make your wish come true.
You probably don't remember the petite blonde who hugged her accordion close and played a special polka for President Reagan, but she will never forget that day. Vlasta Krasek, a housewife from Berwyn, had made her way into the national spotlight with one of her many original compositions. The moment was a long time in coming, since Vlasta started playing before the Second World War.
The man really who written the roll off the barrel, the verbal polka,
I actually learned that from the maestro himself when I was around 6 years old.
She went on to play in Czechoslovakian films, but her childhood acting ended when Vlasta left for the United States with her mother and brother. She married young, had 2 children, and went to work as a factory dispatcher. But 6 years ago, she was laid off and decided to make a musical comeback. She performed at restaurants and bars around Chicago and wrote polkas for the Polish Union Solidarity, for a local DJ. There was even a song for her bird, Freddie, with whom she talks often.
Pedro! No, yo! Come on! Yo! Yo!
I have a bird named Freddie. He is always ready to say hello, hello. I have a bird named Freddie. He is always ready. He follows me wherever I go. Whenever I feel moody or sad, and no one listened to my troubles I've had. But now I have my bird named Freddie. He is always ready to say hello, hello. Freddie, talk to me, it feels so good, 'cause my guy don't love me the way he should. Freddie, your kisses aren't as sweet as wine, but Freddie, you're a happy bird of mine. La, la,
then came a time la, la, of religious inspiration. Pope John Paul came to Chicago, and Vlasta decided to tell that story in song.
I felt I was blessed. I didn't even think I had enough marbles to do that, write the song I've written about what he said, what he did, and where he went. And that became John Paul II Polka, which later the Holy Father, you know, sent me a beautiful letter that he'll pray for me.
John Paul II, he loves you in so far. Good night now, go to sleep. The planets in just fight. Their brothers, sisters, and little children too. From the old world to the new world, John Paul said, I love you. Means ya, koham, ba.
Since writing that tune, Vlasta's own prayers have been answered by a call from the David Letterman Show. She was flown to New York for an appearance and treasures pictures of herself with David and his band. But the taste of stardom has only made Vlasta more determined. She vows to bring polka into the 80s, says she listens to Elvis, the Beatles, and Bruce Springsteen for inspiration, and hopes that her next triumph will come on the Carson Show.
You know, when I played for the president, everybody said, Vlasta, gee, what do you want? You know, you've really got to the top. And I said, no, you don't get to the top till you're on Johnny Carson's show. And that's what my dream is. I would love to be on Johnny Carson and teach him how to do the polka. And that's why I've written this song, especially for him.
Come on, folks, and hear me out what I have to say. It's all about your host. Johnny Carson is his name. He's on each evening entertaining you. Yes, on tonight's show he made that polka too.
On the Chicago Beat, I'm Sandy Houseman. Dave Jaffe insists the music from Farm Aid is still ringing in his ears, and perhaps his pride is still hurting, too.
I spent a lot of time behind the scenes at Farm Aid so I could tell all my friends, oh, sure, I spent a lot of time behind the scenes at Farm Aid. Mostly I just wandered around the press tent clutching my media pass and hoping somebody wearing a cowboy hat would tap me on the shoulder and say, Dave Jaffe, y'all gotta come with me. Willie says he won't go on less than he talks to you. That never happened. In fact, I was pretty much ignored. Probably someone had given me the wrong press credentials, not realizing my importance. Media passes varied in worth depending on their color and shape. You could judge a reporter's esteem by his pass, much as you can judge an Arabian prince's wealth by his jewels. The best pass to have was a gold-trimmed, hard plastic card that read, Willie Nelson Family. This was rare, and let you backstage, where, I assume, Willie gave you a firm handshake, clapped you on the back, and invited you on stage to join him in a chorus of On the Road Again. The most worthless pass was a green, sticky-backed piece of paper with a number 6 on it. This pass impressed the beefy security guards about as much as waving a piece of Kleenex at them. I had a 6. I borrowed another reporter's 6 and told a guard, "Add 'em up, buddy. I'm a 12. We both chuckled over that before he told me to get out of the way. Back at the press tent, a gold badger casually mentioned that Willie himself was on his way to talk to reporters. Quick as a newsman, I stationed myself behind a food table near the entrance. Willie would be sure to see me, and maybe he could straighten out this credentials mix-up. Just seconds before he arrived, a huge fellow wearing a Drink Pepsi shirt and shouldering 2 beverage tanks blocked my view. "I gotta hook this up," he snarled. "I can't see," I explained. "Ladies and gents, Willie Nelson," said the gold badger. "I can't see anything," I whimpered. "This'll just take a second, Mac," said Pepsi. 10 minutes later, Willie was gone. 15 minutes later, Pepsi was gone. I wandered dazed from the tent. A bunch of kids were hanging over the fence, hoping to spot the stars. "Tell us what Willie said," one begged me. I squared my shoulders and smiled. "Willie said he never, ever drinks Pepsi." I'm Dave Jaffe on the Chicago Beat.
On the road again.
It's a typical Saturday night. Neither of you knows what you want to do, so you settle for a movie or dinner at the same neighborhood restaurant. It doesn't have to be that way, though. Gretchen Moore has made it her job to compile a list of unusual and romantic things to do in Chicago. Though she usually shares that list only for a fee through the Learning Annex, she did it for us for free once we promised to take her on one of her favorite tours of the city by horse and buggy.
It's something that a lot of people don't necessarily do or think of unless they're a tourist. And yet it is a wonderful thing to do, whether it's in warm weather when we're all sweltering from the city, as we are here today, or in the fall when we have to use blankets and sort of cuddle up with the person that we're with. Gives you a different perspective of the city.
We boarded the buggy just off Michigan Avenue on Chestnut. From there, we headed north on Lakeshore Drive to the always romantic Arturo's.
Arturo's is romantic because, first of all, it's a very European flavor. Dimly lit, lovely flowers at the table, a pianist in the background, and exquisite service.
If you want to get out of the going out to dinner rut completely, why not grab a few towels and head for the Atlantis Hot Tub Spa at Chicago and Franklin.
There's 5 different rooms and 5 different themes. So you can pretend that you're on a holiday in Hawaii, or you're in Mexico City, or that you've just left Chicago and are relaxing in Japan. You will have piped in music, you'll have a shower, you'll have towels. It's best suggested not to drink because you may just go to sleep or get sick. But you have an enormous hot tub and you can lock the door for an hour, and whatever you would like to do, you can do.
That costs about $20 an hour and might run into big bucks for a full evening of fun, but it is possible to spend a romantic evening for little or no money.
One of the things that you could do would be to rent a tent and to snuggle up in your own backyard if you don't happen to live in a high-rise. You can do this by calling a U-Haul rental.
And of course, there are always long walks in the park, summer concerts under the stars downtown, and bike rides. The truly adventurous can even rent a canoe to travel the Chicago River. And there's nothing wrong with the really touristy stuff, like the horse and buggy ride, or a trip around the lake on the Wendella boats.
I think because we see these things going on all the time, people sometimes just ignore it. They're real obvious. And they're a lot of fun. And why not play like you're on vacation and do some of
the things that normally maybe you wouldn't do.
Still hung up on the nightlife? 666 North Lakeshore Drive is the address of the hottest new bar in Chicago. It's so small that even its name is a warning that you'll be packed in.
Sardine Bar is the size of my living room, and it probably holds, when they're having good entertainment on Friday and Saturday nights, as many perhaps as 140 people. They serve White Castle hamburgers, and White Castle hamburgers at $2.95, which is a joke, and they sell hundreds of them on a weekend. There are 40 millionaires that live in the building, ladies. So if you're hunting, I'm sure that once in a while they stop in after a hard day of work.
Continuing along on our horse and buggy ride, Gretchen spotted another great place to relax after a hard day at work.
Right over here, Marge, by the Marriott, on the top floor, is the most gorgeous, romantic place to swim. You do not even have to be a guest of the Marriott to swim there. It's on the top floor. It's glassed in. You can just go up there and for $9, swim, relax, go in the jacuzzi together, sit by the side of the pool for hours and have your margaritas or whatever you would like to do.
So you've had a leisurely swim, dinner at that dark, quiet place, a romantic walk through the park, but you still aren't ready to go to his place or to hers. Gretchen has one more stop that you can't afford to pass up if it's 4 o'clock Sunday morning.
That is when the floral trucks are coming in. And that is when you can present her with the largest bouquet of roses she's ever had in her whole life for pennies. You buy them right off the flower stand as they're being unloaded. But it's definitely a romantic thing for a man to say is, I want to buy you the biggest bouquet of posies that you've ever had. Let's go. And you're driving into this strange warehouse neighborhood. She's going to wonder, what on earth and where on earth are you really going? And then you pull up and you can buy her perhaps 36 roses for $7. Wouldn't that be great?
This list should get you started, but to be sure you never again run out of new and different ideas for a Saturday night, Gretchen suggests you treat the someone special in your life to a subscription to Chicago Magazine or one of the many new guides to the local scene. What is your most vivid memory of 1964? Perhaps it was the Warren Report's conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Maybe it was the Goldwater campaign. Or if you were glued to the tube, you might recall the premiere episode of The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
One years after The Man from U.N.C.L.E. guaranteed Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin enshrinement in the pantheon of television spy shows, several dozen disciples of those agents from U.N.C.L.E. staged a convention in the Chicago suburbs last weekend. They gathered to honor the entire genre of 60 spy stories on television and in movies, but the majority pledged first fealty to The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
A lot of us, we went from like kid TV shows, and this is like one of the first adult TV shows we really were attracted to, because most of the people were like between the ages of 9 to 12, 13 years old. And it's basically one of the first TV shows that really caught our eye, and then we went with it.
Linda Mendoza organized SpyCon 3, and people came from California and New Jersey and New Orleans and New York and Canada to swap iSpy tennis rackets and Get Smart shoe telephones and the Mr. Phelps self-destructing Mission Impossible tape recorder and the Avengers Emma Peel paper doll dress-up book with an emphasis on leathers. Or how about subscribing to the McCallum Observer, a magazine dedicated exclusively to following the career of the actor who played Napoleon Solo's Soviet sidekick. These are serious spy fans who dress up in U.N.C.L.E. jackets and t-shirts and who bid on collectibles donated by people like Robert Vaughn or David McCallum or Bill Cosby or Robert Culp or by the producer-creator of U.N.C.L.E., Norman Felton.
The biggest one was some cufflinks that were given to Norman Felton by Ian Fleming, and he donated them. They went for $105. Cute little guns, silver guns. They're wonderful.
Janine Dubell listed other memorabilia auctioned for charity. I Spy still, signed by Bill Cosby. A complete mint set of Man from U.N.C.L.E. bubblegum cards. The original 45 RPM record of the James Bond theme. Bill Paratio flew to Chicago from New Jersey because it was important to him to be here.
I've been an Uncle fan since it aired, and when I was about 9 years old when the show first aired in 1964, and it just struck a nerve with me. It turned out to be a very entertaining show, and I really got hooked on it. And when I heard about the club, which was about 3 or 4 years ago, I joined. And the first convention 2 years ago, I decided I was going to spend the money and fly out here for it, and I've been glad I've been coming ever since.
I was surprised to learn that since those 105 original episodes were retired to cable syndication, the adventures of the men from Uncle continued. The Pulp Press has been satisfying Uncle fanatics with anthologies like Tales of Two Uncles and the Curiocan File, and there have even been stories written that combine the Uncle characters with those of club members' other favorites. How about, and I'm not making this up, The Men from U.N.C.L.E. visit the MASH 4077. And I doubt you knew that the ashes of Leo G. Carroll, who died a few years after his portrayal of U.N.C.L.E. Chief Alexander Waverly, have never been interred. They're in a cemetery storage room in California.
The Leo G. Carroll Fund is a fund that is being run by a girl whose name escapes me at the moment. He evidently does not have a proper and dignified resting place in California, and this girl has decided that she would like to see him properly entombed with a proper memorial, and so she's trying to raise money to do that.
There were some Man from U.N.C.L.E. fans who could not be here this year. It happens that David McCallum is in a play in a New Jersey dinner theater, so they flew there instead. And as SpyCon 3 concluded, some conventioners were already booking their passage to next year's science fiction convention outside New Orleans, featuring the cast of the long-dead daytime horror soap Dark Shadows, or to next month's Hollywood Super Fair in Hillside, where Gene Autry movies will be run continuously. And they'll all be back for SpyCon 4 next year. I'm Dave McBride on the Chicago Beat.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. With every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow.
I'm Marge Halperin. You can hear the Chicago Beat the final Sunday of each month at midnight. Thanks for joining us.